So today, by the way, the list is pretty full. We kind of managed to have two separate tracks, if you like, two separate things. So there's one block with German only and one block with English only, almost. So if you take a look at the schedule in the wiki, you can see what's going to happen. And as soon as I'm online, I also know what's going to happen. So, yeah, we want to maybe rearrange this just a little because we got a few requests to move some up front. Yes, we would like you to join us on the IRC channel. So that's on Freenode, and the channel name is #26C3LT for Lightning Talks, LT for Lightning Talks. So we want you to give us some feedback, even on the small mishaps. And if you have, you know, anything about the talks themselves, you can find some links online, please post them to the channel. We'll take a look at it later, and we hope to document it even better with your help. That would be nice. Yes, this day is pretty full. The next 2 days only have a few talks already. But if everything goes quite okay, then we should have at least 20 talks each day. So there's free space for more talks. We want your talks. So please send us an email to 26c3@lightningtalks.de. Again, 26c3@lightningtalks.de. Please send us your slides, your requests, or simply just an abstract so we can add this and update the schedule. We're running a little late with the schedule. We just updated this morning at 5 a.m., but we hope to do this even on shorter this afternoon or maybe this evening. So please send your requests. Or if you have an idea about contact this guy, he should come up stage, please send us that too. Oh yes, just a reminder for the speakers, please come up to front row. I see a few speakers there already. But if you are a speaker and you sit there, please come up front. What we will do is we will give you a headset and we want to know who's there. So if there's any speakers in the audience still up there, please come to first row. Okay? Okay. So we have the first speaker here. Let's change this. Whoops.
Good morning.
Yeah. Du kriegst ein Headset?
Ja. Hab ich schon.
Macht schon. Funktioniert's auch?
Das weiß ich nicht.
Alright. So.
Okay.
Wow. Audio? 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 Audio Angel? Hello? Audio Angel? Hey. Okay, turn this down. Turn him up, please. Thanks.
So? Ganz aus, oder?
Ja,
So, jetzt hört ihr mich auch. Also, Rückkopplung. Okay, guten Morgen, mein Name ist Daniel. Ich werde über Hack the Government reden, ein Open Data Hack Day zu Open Government, Open Data and Transparency. Der wird stattfinden am 17. 18. April hier in Berlin. Warum machen wir einen Open Data Hack Day überhaupt? Naja, es gibt total viel Daten. Oh, sorry, I should speak in English. This data is produced for public purposes. It's actually financed with our taxes. Digitalization makes access and distribution so easy, so there's no reason for any limitation on access, use, remix, and distribution. One word about open data and democracy. Obviously, access to information is a civil right. Informed decisions are only possible with access to data and information. And finally, responsible citizens are good for our democracy. There's a threefold benefit with access to that data. First is on an individual decision-making. Second is the potential for innovations and economy. And the third is, finally, government, public sector, administration, and social changes become more transparent. The way we organize information is rapidly changing. Websites become platforms, transparency invokes interactivity, consumers become people who make stuff, and there's more data in the world than ever. Think about the state as a service machine. We put taxes in, and we get things out like infrastructure and services and data. But most government websites suck. There are three laws of open government data. Sometimes officials from administrations tell me, yeah, but, well, we publish some data on our websites. You can download a PDF. We have to say that's not enough. Open government data, if it can't be spidered or indexed, it doesn't exist. If it is not available in open machine-readable format, it can't engage. And if a legal framework doesn't allow it to be repurposed, it doesn't empower. Remember, it's our data that we are talking about. We paid taxes for it. About the event, Hack the Government, it's a hack day, I said it already. So if you're in Berlin or you want to travel here, please welcome, save the date. What we're going to do, we'll use government and public sector data to build apps and prototypes that help us to make government more transparent and open, empower citizens, invoke participation and collaboration. Why? Well, fun. Governments produce a lot of data, said it already, but that data often is not publicly available and open. That concerns access, licenses, and formats. What we're going to do? We're going to spend 2 days of time. We will scrape some data and mix it with creative people, hopefully you, to actually make that data available and accessible, build apps and prototypes, and show what can be done with government and public service data. Save the date. Check out the website. It's opendata.hackday.net. Or follow us on Twitter on OpenDataHack. I'd like to state Tim O'Reilly here. So if you think government and its data should be open, it's up to our community to respond with our ideas, with our voices, with our creativity, and with our code. Get involved, participate in the event, create and share, and finally, DIY. So if you're living in another city or even in another country and you want to do something similar, like an open government hack day or a hack day on open government data, just do it and make sure you get in touch with us because we would like to get this as a European movement. Thank you. There's some interest.
Okay, 1, 2. Okay, thanks. The next talk is MyFair Classic Universal Toolkit, or MFUC. It's a free implementation of the MyFair Classic DarkSide attack and nested authentication attacks. Both tools help in recovering unknown keys for MyFair Classic card sectors.
Okay.
Okay, hello everyone, sorry for the delay. I'm Andrei.
My name is Pavel.
We would like to announce and start my FAQ project is an intentional misspell of my favorite classic universal toolkit. Basically, we independently released some free open source implementations. As a lot of you might know, the My Favorite cards are mostly the most used RFID cards in the world. You can find it in transport cards, in building access systems, and in credit cards or parking cards, so many, many more things. And it's normally something estimated to 200 million in production. Some very, very known data for RFID standard in MyFair Classic, and it's been under microscope directly and indirectly since 2007. And it was proven to be completely broken since then, up to 2009, and it's classified as kindergarten cryptography by Bruchner. So you see what the problem is. And basically, we would like to release a toolkit which basically can help you or any researcher, any security assessment to investigate the system and reveal the keys in almost instantly, but we will have to work on this.
Okay, so our goal is to create a universal MyFair Classic cracker. At this moment, we developed two different tools. The first tool was developed by our company, Netfemba. We did the first world implementation, not the first, but the first public implementation of nested authentication attack. Using this method, you can crack almost MyFair Classic card when you know at least one known or at least one default key. So if this condition is fulfilled, you can recover all keys for all sectors. Andrei developed his tool called MyFair Classic Darkside Key Recovery Tool. He decided to implement different kind of attack called Darkside Attack. This attack was firstly described by RFID researcher Nicolas Courtois. So using this tool, you are able even to discover a non-default key. And when you have this non-default key, you can use, for example, our nested authentication attack tool and discover all keys for all MyFair Classic cards. So our goal is to build universal toolkit that implements all this functionality just in one tool. It should be open source. It should be GPL, portable code. At this moment, it's international project. Everybody can participate and try to improve it.
Yes, basically we are not the first one to have these kinds of tools. The researchers had this, but we are the first one to release this open source completely, and we want to get people involved. Maybe we can get more optimal results and maybe push to some security distro like Backtrack or something like this. And things to come which we are currently working on are some full emulation. Meaning that you can actually emulate the entire card, including the unique ID, not only the data on it, which is a little bit of a problem at this moment to fully emulate with some readers. Or also, we are trying to target different ways for emulation in the future, like maybe the Nokia will be there, but because it's a more ubiquitous tool to use the emulation, you just use the phone. Okay, and basically you don't draw attention on yourself when you use the Nokia in your hand to sniff the data or to emulate some data. So we have pretty some vectors to advance this, but if you want to learn about this crypto one protocol and implementation of cryptography and MyFair Classic and RFID, feel free to join, and we have some stub URLs for the code and the group of discussion, so feel free to participate.
So if you are interested in any kind of micro classic hacking, just contact us after this presentation. Okay, thank you a lot.
Thank you.
So,
Ramiro?
Okay, the next lightning talk will be about a new Linux distribution based on hand-selected collection of tools for each task, and each tool being statically linked. And after that, we will hear about open RFID tags, if Ramiro is in the room. Okay, maybe he's sleeping still, I don't know. So after Anselm talking about the new Linux distro, we will hear Adrian and Alan from Meet for Real. Is that okay? Good. And after Meet for Real... Yeah, after Meet for Real, we would like to hear about from Alexander Ott about Hacking Education Reloaded. Alexander, are you here? Okay. So it's Dünkel then at the cert. Yeah, okay. So you ready?
Yes.
Okay, have your time.
Yes. Hello, I'm Anselm from the Sucklist.org project, and I started a new project a couple of weeks ago called STALI, which stands for Static Linux. And this is a new Linux distribution, the only one I am aware of that has its primary focus on statically linked binaries only, which means the aim is that this distribution does not consist of any dynamically linked binaries. Get into detail a little bit later on the next slide. Basically I have to give some background. What upsets me, you have seen I'm using Windows XP on this presentation right now. This is because of Vodafone mobile internet access. It doesn't work on Linux. This is my excuse. So, but what upsets me is that I spend a lot of time configuring and fiddling around with usual Linux distributions, and STALI aims at end users, and it's not supposed to be yet another experimental distribution. Hence, it consists of a collection of the best tools we think and we found in the open source area, and it also features all the Sucklist tools, of course. Another difference to normal distributions is the radically cleansed file system structure. STALI does not or attempts to get rid of the user directory and a bunch of other directories. Okay, so what's the intention behind a statically linked only distribution? I don't want to go too much into detail here, but basically we identified that a statically linked only distribution produces smaller binaries. If you get rid of GNU libc, you will see you can have smaller binaries that are statically linked than the GNU libc dynamic counterparts. And this also results in lesser memory consumption. And because we link only to certain parts of a static library, each binary, usually this produces more secure binaries. And because it's statically linked only, each binary has a much faster start-up time. So the overall performance starting up a static or executing a statically linked binary is about 400% faster than dynamically load binaries. Okay, so if you want to follow up with all this, just visit this URL, mail me or give me a call. I'll be around today in this building. Okay, thank you.
Can everyone hear me?
Not yet.
Okay, there he goes. Be loud. Hi, I'm Ellen, and this is Adrian, and
Hello.
We're from Meet for Real in Ireland. And today we want to talk about designing for socialization. So basically, we're really passionate about socializing, about meeting new people and learning new things, because we think you can learn so much more when you meet new people. And basically, we found in Ireland that it's kind of hard to meet new people. So we think that it's broken. And we wanted to see, by looking at social patterns over time and see how things have changed, that maybe we could hack the way that the brain works. Maybe we could hack the environments that we socialize in to maybe make talking to strangers more fun and easier. So we looked at a couple of things, like, say, breakfast cereal. In Ireland, I don't know if it's the same here, but over time, like, there'd be pictures on the back of breakfast cereal, and they've got these happy families, and they're all having fun eating cereal together. But actually, breakfast cereal was, like, one of the things sugar, I think it's untimed. But it contributed to the decline of families eating breakfast together, because you could eat cereal by yourself. So a little kid can pour his own milk into a cereal, so he doesn't need mom, and they don't have breakfast together anymore. This one, then, is trains, public transport. People used to socialize when they travel together. But then trains became a more anonymous form of travel. But obviously, you can see in this train in India... how am I going to turn that off?
Return.
In this train in India, it's kind of hard to ignore each other, but there's a phrase called civil inattention, which is what we've kind of a word that we've made up for the way that we politely ignore each other when we're on a train. So we look into the newspaper, we stare into the distance, and we've even designed trains to make it easier for us to ignore each other by putting the seats in this kind of configuration. And so we also looked at things like, say, social networks. So there's great ways for you to meet strangers online. You can use Imvu, Second Life, forums, all that kind of stuff, Twitter. And there's great ways for you to socialize with your existing friends online, like Farmville and Facebook, or lots of games, social games online. But we thought, like, this isn't good enough. You know, I mean, computers are great, and we all love spending a lot of time in front of the computers, but we're social animals. Emotions are contagious. If I see a cute guy and I make eye contact with him, I'm going to get dopamine released in my brain, and it's like a completely emotional reaction. So we wanted to see if we could make that better.
So now basically, that's, you see, we go to a lot of events, and we know like technology is amazing. We've achieved so much for the last 20 years, 40 years, but we're still here. We still love face-to-face, no matter what, and how much hardcore technology we've built. And as you can see, like, we love interacting with each other. So I need to ask you something. How many of you have actually met, spoke to new people? Can you raise your hand? How many of you started the conversation? You say, hey, what's up? Okay, a few of them. Okay, studies have shown that basically, this is real. Basically, they mapped out people in a room. And usually we spend more time with people that we already know than with people that we just don't know, right? And why is this? Well, it's interesting enough because our brain, basically, we were hunter-gatherers for 2 million years, and we spent all our time in a group of 150, 100 people, individuals, right? So our brain is basically hardwired to get to know 150 people, and as a tribe, we were never basically interacting with other foreign tribes. So basically, it's in our brains. So it's interesting to see, how can we hack this? So basically, we're starting with the iPhone, and basically we want to build iPhone app that basically, you have it, right? And once you have it, you can put on in a question, whatever triggers you. And then this iPhone app is not just you can have it on your own. The trick is just you can pass it along, and you can ask other people about interesting stuff that you're just thinking on the spot. So we're thinking about this app, pass it along. You get to ask people about something you're curious about, and then kind of centralize that data into our servers so you can see what people are asking around the world, and hopefully, that's our ultimate intention, is to basically people to talk to strangers and have more interesting conversations with each other so we live in a happier world, hopefully. And, we're here, we live in Ireland, and we're fascinated being here. And if you guys have any questions or you have any suggestions of how can we hack it better and use technology for it, we're open to any questions. And this is Twitter, and Meet For Real, and I'm Adrian, and she's Ellen. Thanks, guys.
Oh, sure. Super. Ist da? Super. Nee, ist nicht da. Moment. One moment, please. I guess I have to have to check that. Aber doch hier noch schon, ne? Mirroring. Ja, perfekt. Okay. Hello, I'm Daniel or Plex, and I'm from the DynCall project, which is an open source project started 2 years ago about low-level things that can be done to interact with scripting languages in binary components. And on top of this, I will give a short overview of DynPorts, an idea or vision how we can create a component object model like Microsoft had years ago, but for several platforms. So when we are working with dynamic languages, we often wish to extend functionality with OpenGL, multimedia libraries, and the like. And the typical way to do it is just to extend it language by language, reading the manual, how to build the bindings. That is very cumbersome, and we were thinking very strong about the idea of having some kind of middleware We call it Dynport. Let's say we already have built that, although the only thing that works is R now. This middleware would look like this. We define some type information for every shared library once, and not for each platform, but only once for the source code itself, put it in a repository, and all connected languages can profit from the binary functionality, given that the binary is installed. Or even we can build some kind of Gentoo emerge system that already installs it for Windows, macOS. Now, we started very low level to study all kinds of processor architectures because we want to make this call work. That means we have contact with machine code. So we studied processors, platforms, C compilers, and established a list of calling conventions, which we also documented in a 50 pages document, which is also open source. And we see, for example, that the x86 platform has a lot of calling conventions, and we have to use them because, for example, standard libraries like OpenGL use standard call, while your normal libraries would use cdecl. So we really have to handle that. And many foreign function interfaces doesn't support that. So we started to write a library, the Dyncall library. It consists of a front end and a processor backend, where we have all calling conventions available at runtime. So I can make a call, even to OS foreign code, using first the calling convention, then I get a call engine, then I load the arguments in a designated order, and then I call a small call kernel, which is handwritten in assembly, to establish this call, which can be seen as a generic call engine. Now, looking at the language implementation, here we have the R language. We want to make a call to the SDL set video mode. Given that we already loaded the DLL or the shared object or macho object, we have that pointer. We want to communicate in a scripting language with it. Now comes the idea, we are using a text string, a signature string, to specify the C calling conventions in our beloved scripting language. That looks like this. The format is argument types, then a closing bracket, and a return type. And this is implemented currently for Python, Lua, Ruby, and R. And these are the types we are supporting. We're also using C types, not specified 32 or 64-bit types, so that we can also work on 32-bit as well as 64-bit systems to interact, for example, with OpenGL. Now, to bind the whole library, we experiment currently with using some parser or compiler tools like BoostWave for the C preprocessor defines, and GCC XML and XSLT to extract type information or function calls, so that we get constants, calls, and structures. And if you like, I could show you a very short demo if I still have time. Git very quickly, okay. Okay, two demos. This one is just a simple OpenGL application where we load OpenGL in the R environment. R doesn't know anything about OpenGL, doesn't know anything about Windows, and the only thing that R knows is Dyncall, the small layer to make calls. That's it. This one works on Windows, Linux, macOS. And we can go even further. If you want to work with OpenGL 3.0 API, which is really a little bit tricky, because you don't have symbols anymore, you have pointers to symbols, we can also get around this. For example, sorry, the Mandelkube. This one is using shader technology, and also R doesn't know anything about it. Wait, I can. So everything is scripted in R, and the only thing that is in C is Dyncall, no other C glue code. So you can find the project on the website dyncall.org. Everything is open source, BSD style. The Dynport prototype can be seen in the R bindings, which is also on the Subversion repository. And there we are still fiddling. So if anybody's interested in language design, middleware design, we would like to hear from you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay, Plex, thank you for that demonstration. Next, we will hear about from Ingo how to build your own box scanner. And after that lightning talk, we will get introduced to the crypto stick. So that are the next two lightning talks.
Next time I'm going to give a talk about what can possibly go wrong. And it takes 2 hours. So, I don't know. Do you have can we take yours maybe? Or? That would be nice. It's whatever happened here, I don't know. All right.
Got it on memstick?
Yeah. Oh, he's got a memstick there. And fuck.
Oh, man. Weil ich denn I denke genau. Just one. It's okay. What is next? Can I do it with space or which button?
Up down.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Hello, so my name is Ingo and I want to introduce to you the do-it-yourself book scanner project. It's about how to build your own book scanner at home with cheap materials and easy to build up. Yeah, based on open source hardware and software. Yeah, I will begin with a demonstration, with illustration of some devices which were already built in the community by some people, so it's only a selection. That's the most simple one, but they increase the professionality. So, you see here the basic principle. There's a camera, at least one for, to capture each page. So the goal is to capture all the pages in the book with the digital camera.
So this is an alternate design, book upside down, and yeah, it's rotated for the even and the odd pages at 90 degrees. And this is a simple setup, which is also portable. Can be made of even more rough materials. And recycle some old toys. So what's the basic idea behind? It will enable you to create digital copies of the book you own already and enable you to carry the knowledge you own everywhere and anytime. Yeah, there are a lot of reasons to do this. This was just one example. Another would be, for example, to have full text search, which is always nice to have on all the literature you have in on wood. Yeah, another example. Yeah, and what's important to stress here is that not everybody needs to build such a device. It's a device to share among interested individuals. So build local groups if you're interested in such a device, and gather and combine your resources to set such thing up. So it's maybe an interesting device to a must-have device for hackerspaces, maybe, probably. And the main idea is there's a community which already built some devices. Some of them you have seen here, and they already gathered some information, some experiences and information, and will help you out with any ongoing projects. And as you can see, there are digital cameras. Here's the basic setup, a bit more illustrated. That's the most advanced device, which were created by Daniel Reeds in the US. He couldn't come here to the Congress. It's even portable. On top, you see the lightning and two digital cameras. On the bottom is in a V-shaped the book stored. The pages are flattened by the also V-shaped acrylic plating, which are pushed down manually, and but you still have manually flipped the pages. This V-shaped plating are moved up, and pages are flipped and then moved down again, and there's a remote shutter release on the handle to release this. There's also you see there are there's room for improvements, for example automatic page flipping, and also how to do this without destroying the book and without the risk of destroying the book. And also there are digital cameras. There's a lot of challenges in digital image processing, pre-processing for optical character recognition if you want to do that, and even improved optical character recognition. So the best software for this is sadly commercial at the time, and even that is far from perfect if you want an exact digital copy. This is the same device collapsed. It couldn't be put in a bag and transported everywhere where you want to go. Thank you. And this information I'm free. I'm open to any questions and comments. That's all.
Präsentation? Ich bräuchte nur die Präsentation von der Messe.
Can I get a very strict 1 minute warning? German-like, schnell, schnell. Thanks.
It was there, it's fine, it's... And once I switch, fuck.
It helps me if I just can look at them locally.
Ich meine, ich kann den X neu starten, dann tut es, aber es ist halt alles Hochzeit. Okay.
You could, if you want that we use a presentation PC, you can all vote online, or even better, go to the guys and tell them to actually give us this thing. Thank you.
No.
Could we have the other PC again, please?
Okay.
Whenever there's a place when the hard disk dies, this is the time. So. Fuck. Yeah. I think you have a dead hard disk here now. I don't believe this.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you.
Flash, internet, what? Is it online?
Don't
Sven,
know.
Where's the file?
The files are on the dying hard disk right now.
I can't magically get it off. Is it online? I have a memory stick if you need it.
Okay, small announcement for everybody. So, who is there anyone in the audience who has not got accommodation for the next night? Because if you don't, then you should contact Nick Farr. Nick Farr is in charge of some of the hostel sites here. And if you need accommodation, please contact him. He should be downstairs in heaven. Yeah, downstairs in heaven, get it? And you can also reach him at Dectphone Nick. So just type N-I-C-K and you reach him. So if you need accommodation, contact Nick.
These are all PDF. Okay, one second.
Kann man gar nicht machen. Also von mir aus kein Problem mehr.
You're set to go?
Good morning.
Okay.
So, good morning again. My name is Jan. I'm from the German Privacy Foundation and want to give you a short introduction on our crypto stick. So, what is a crypto stick? Next page. So, for those people who know the OpenPGP smart card, well, this one. So, for those people who know the OpenPGP smart card, the crypto stick, hello. The crypto stick is just a combination. Thanks. Okay, The CryptoStick is a combination of this smart card, OpenPGP card, and a USB smart card adapter. So this is a very short explanation. For those people who don't know the OpenPGP card, the CryptoStick is this. It is not an USB storage stick. It is a stick containing a smart card. The smart card is used to store secret keys, for example, for OpenPGP or GNUPG cryptography. So the idea is that those keys are secured in the smart card. So if you lost this key, if you lost this stick, no one will get to your keys because it's protected in the smart card. The access to the smart card is PIN protected, so by your own passphrase. And even in a laboratory where you open the stick and go to the hardware and to the memory and so, it is not easy and in practice potentially not possible in the moment to get on the data. So this means all cryptographic procedures are processed on the smart card, are on the stick. Yeah, there's no way to export the keys. And you can also just generate the keys on the stick so that they never got exposed to a PC. You can use three independent keys for authentication, encryption, and signature. You can use RFA keys up to a length of 3072 bit. So this is new instead of the previous version of the OpenPGP card, where the maximum length was 1024 bit. So this is state of the art. It's compatible to, I guess, all operating systems. Mac OS, I'm not sure about. We will test it soon. But open source software works pretty well, like GNUPG, but version 2, not version 1. You can use it with Thunderbird, Enigmail easily, so you have a proper graphical user interface. For SSH and other software is supported as well. The whole project is open source. This means the software is or at least will be a GPL soon. And hardware is open source as well. So if you want to build this stick by your own, you can download the hardware layout. It's released under a Creative Commons license and build the stick by your own. We are... Okay. Okay, so currently...
Press space.
Good. So currently we have version 1. This is what I'm just talking about. It's available. We are just selling it to get back our cost for the parts. They are pretty expensive. And we have to add some tax on this. So we don't make any profit with this. It's just to get our money back. You can buy it now, but we are already developing on version 2. This will include a storage. The storage will encrypt it transparently on the stick, so no software installation or something like that is required or will be required. And the data format of the storage will be compatible to DMCrypt or Lux, which is known from the Linux world, proper known and supposed to be secure format for those data, encrypted data. But it's not bound to any Linux or Windows or Mac OS file format. This is just the next level. So you can use it with Linux, Windows, whatever. We will have a new case, so a strong aluminium case, which so you can wash the key and or the stick and do whatever you like with it. It probably will not break. And our goal is to develop the most secure portable stick on the market. So there are some commercial products, but they are not secure, not really secure. They don't have smart cards or any comparable level of security. They are just, well, some work, some don't. But we will be very secure because we rely on open source, we rely on well-known security technologies like smart card and those well-known formats. So if you like to get involved in the project, we welcome you. So we are looking for software developers, probably like every other project, but Serious, if you have any questions or are interested in the development or want to buy a stick, you can contact us by email, or just you will find me after the session somewhere here and just talk to me. Okay, thank you.
Test. Okay, so the next lightning talk will be about why we should hack hearing devices, and after that we will hear about the free rainbow tables. So next one is how to hack hearing devices, and after that lightning talk about the free rainbow tables.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Hi, I'm Helga. I'm talking about hacking hearing devices. Unfortunately, I have to switch off my hearing devices because of this microphone thing, so it's like one directional. Hearing devices are those little devices you get when you cannot hear very well, and modern hearing devices have quite interesting features.
Okay, that's weird. Didn't have focus.
Yeah, first of all, they got really small and nearly invisible, so most people don't notice it. When I wear them, they basically consist of microphones and speakers and a little computer inside. Those computers have really powerful signal processing. They recognize different acoustic settings, from which direction your conversation partner is talking to you. They can filter out unwanted noises like wind, for example. Hearing devices can talk to each other to create some kind of directional hearing, and they can talk to other hardware. So you can use them as headset, for example. Yeah, and this doesn't work.
It works great.
Okay, so why do I want to hack them? So this is basically about I want to hack them, and I haven't hacked them that much up till now. First of all, if you can't open it, you don't own it, and you have to pay a lot of money for the hearing devices, and I would like to have know better what it's inside. So I would like to free the information. And besides that, of course, it's technically interesting, and we don't really need a reason to hack something. The obstacles in hacking hearing devices are that the market is really proprietary and closed. It's hard to get any information. Even the information for the acousticians is a lot less technical than I was hoping for. The hardware is expensive. You don't get paid the whole amount by the insurance companies. And it's hard to buy any used hearing devices on eBay because it's not allowed to sell them there because they are medical devices. Then if you start hacking your own hearing devices at the risk of injury, you can damage your hearing even more. So it's more safe to first start with the peripherals like the Bluetooth adapters or something. And there's always the warranty that you can damage. And since when you break your own hearing devices and you're kind of dependent on them, it's a little bit complicated. So what are my visions? I would like to adjust the parameters of my hearing devices by myself. Right now, you always have to go to your acoustician, then he adjusts the parameters, and you have to walk around with them for a week, and then you have to go again to adjust them even more, and I would like to do that by myself. I would like to have an affordable Bluetooth support. The companies charge really a lot of money for just some little thingy that does a little Bluetooth, so I hope there's some way to do that with an Arduino or something. And I like to write my own signal processing. So I would like to have filters that filter out certain voices, for example, so you have some kind of ignore list in real life. I would like to hear more than normal people do, so like play around with the frequencies to talk to bats, for example. And since they have speakers and microphones, you can use the devices to spy and record stuff. I'm looking for people who want to join me. I'm looking for information, hardware, software. So if you get your hands on any of that, please drop me an email, or I will be around for the next couple of days. Just come and talk to me. Thank you.
So maybe you want to learn how to clap for the people who cannot hear, I think. Helga, is that right? It's like this? Yeah? Okay, so let's try this. So let's clap. Wow. So many things you can learn on the Congress. Unbelievable. Okay, good. Next one, as I said, is a lightning talk about the free rainbow tables. And after that, we will hear about Encore.org. It's an interactive online presentation software system, whatever. So let's hear about the free rainbow tables and how they don't destroy the rainforest or whatever. So
exactly.
Thank you very much.
Okay, here we go. Let's speed this up. Thanks for all the trouble to show my very silly slides. Okay, talk is about freerainbowtables.com. It's the same website. It uses Boink distributed computing framework to generate the tables, and so far we generated about 1.5 terabytes. Those are indexed and perfected tables. It means they are small and fast. Some links to the mathematics behind that are on the forum. The focus is on cryptographic hashes used for passwords, not for files, no office tables, and so on. So far on LM, NTLM, MD5, SHA-1, and at this time some hashes for MySQL are in the queue. It makes point. Ah. Ah, here we go. We have a small program you need. No, it's gone again. Okay. We have a small program you need to use those tables. It's RCrack IMT. You find it on SourceForge. You need this program. Do not trust any other link. There is all stuff on the website. Just go there. And for Linux, please use the version in the subversion repository from SourceForge. There's also article Free Rainbow Tables in the Congress Wiki. Use this for starters. Most of the information is on our forums. Do not use the RCrackI from the website. So, common myths about rainbow tables. Everyone uses salted hashes these days. Well, of course, that's not true. Everyone is still using unsalted MD5. If you go to a corporate programmer and ask him, please use salted hashes, they are more secure, what will they say if you say use salts? Well, cafeterias on the ground floor. We don't have salt here. So, next common myth is rainbow tables destroy the rainforest. This is on the website of CCC Cologne. Rainbow tables zerstören nur den Regenwald und verbrauchen Plattenplatz. So, let's see if that's true. We used different crackers and measured how much power one of our computers would draw. It's a modest quad-core with small graphics cards. Most power, of course, needs Pirit, VPA PSK proof sourcer who uses the CPU and the GPU. John, running on all cores, draws 520 watts in our RCrack INT. Doing the pre-calculation for a few minutes, of course, needs 520 watts. And, well, as soon as we start reading the tables from a hard disk, it drops to 440 watts. And when we read from SSD, that's just 430 watts. So, myth busted. Ha. We did some speed tests that you see how fast the tables are with our LM table sets. 27 LM hashes, one not in the table set. Table is about 45 gigabytes. and you see here how fast a modest quad-core goes through them, just 16 minutes, and if you put them on an SSD, it's 9 minutes. Of course, using an SSD is overkill. This is a fixed amount. It will only speed up the time, how long you read the whole table. Doesn't matter how many hashes you have. And here, how long it's deformed hashes. I'm speeding this up a bit. Here, you see how long the same computers would take to brute force this with John MPI in incremental mode, in brute forcing mode, or dumb brute force mode. The i7 would need about 18 hours, and the Q9300 quad-core, I think, for about 100 euros or less, would need 2 days. And basically, for GPU-based crackers, cheap GPU would take about the same time. So you see we have a really nice speed advantage with the Rainbow Tables here. So new developments this year, maybe new table format. The table is not running at the moment because we have a current topic here. As you see, we have failing hard drives, and the hard drive of the project failed. And so basically the hard drive of the laptop failed. I really hope it's not bad karma from us. Project activity will resume sometimes next year. And we also had an NFS failure, so the mirror is not up to date. And in order to compensate for this, I brought this here, which is a 1.5 terabyte hard disk. And we are trying to copy it on the Congress servers. And yesterday night, another enclosure failed. One failed when we prepared the talk, so this has been a lot of fun so far. So if you have a server downstairs where we can put a hard disk in and you have some speedy thing which is not USB, because I hate that, then basically talk to me, find me in the hack center. If that doesn't work out, we have already 2 people who will help and who will copy it from their server by USB to one of the NetApp filers. If you haven't noticed, some guy brought a big storage system which maybe costs half a million euros and we can put things on it. And basically, if you had more sleep than I and you are still able to make a working torrent, we would be very grateful because we failed miserably this night. So anyway, thank you for listening. You can just check the Free Rainbow Tables article in the Congress wiki, which I'm also using to update which tables are up. We uploaded SHA-1 this night. We uploaded the LM table. If you represent a group who can help seeding, you can also come to me. And if we have a time slot, we can do a one-on-one copy of the hard drive. It takes about 5 hours, and you have a pristine, forensically sound copy of the Free Rainbow Tables. Where else do you get this? Thank you for listening.
No. Yeah. Okay, fine. So this is presentation software I've written for a cycle of scientific teleconferences I'm running for 1 year now. The idea was that when you're running a scientific presentation, you don't need to have the face of the speaker online, so the video stream is completely useless, basically. So if you can write with Ajax and reverse Ajax, a small thing like that, where you can synchronize, hopefully, well, no, not hopefully, because the internet connection is broken down. Anyway, the idea is to synchronize the change of slides when the speaker press next. Everybody hopefully sees next online in real time. And you also have facilities like virtual laser pointers here, that are available to you to give your presentation. So, so now it should be working. Yeah, fine. So internet has been connecting again. As you see, it's using HTTP in disconnected mode, so it's quite tolerant to faults. If I crash the server and restart it again, it will still work. Yeah, that's because I need Java for the next part, which is a microphone here. So that was the first step. Give a presentation system where anybody can insert slides into the system, have a facility like that, which is a virtual laser pointer, so anybody can see the laser pointer on the screen. If you write the URL, which is here below, you can check that it works online for you in the room. And you have a system where people can ask questions here. So why did I introduce this online chat? Just because when you are in a room, people can ask questions. So at the end of the presentation, you say, okay, who have questions here? So you can raise your hands, blah, blah, blah. But by the phone or with the online audio system, you don't see the people in front of you. So in that case, you need to have a way to write the questions so the speaker knows what to answer. The next thing is that some people do not speak English very well. And in our teleconference cycle, which is here, we have had many, many talks from all over the world. By the way, if there are scientists among you, this is a conference about machine learning and causality. And so we have people from all over the world. And this is using only plain HTTP and JavaScript for the slide transfer. It was tested from Uganda to Pakistan, where we had speakers. And it was working in real-time conditions to give a presentation in these countries. You could not have had a video stream in real-time in the conditions we had with internet breakage every so often. But with a phone line, it was possible, plus a synchronization software on the internet that uses very little amount of bandwidth, basically just the images and JavaScript as AJAX, reverse AJAX. Messages. So the next step was to introduce an integrated audio system because not everybody can phone internal connections. So I wrote my own voice over IP layer using the Speaks codec, so I can show you the architecture here. So the participant can use the browser, which is the plain HTTP. If he has a Java embedded, you can have an applet here on my own voice over IP layer directly on UDP. I used my own protocol because I control everything from end to end. And since I also give the applet in the web page, then I do updates automatically, so there is no conflict whatsoever of software from one end to another. This simplifies things greatly because if you just load the URL which is given here, then if you have Java, press microphone is on and everybody can hear you in the audience. And you have nothing to do. Okay. So the next step was to write an asterisk plugin here, so people can still connect by phone if they want to. And right now, in this internal teleconference, which I invite you to join, we have this software working, and we can even make video replays for. Okay, so this is one replay I made, and. Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's just a bit slow right now. The internet connection is not working very well. Anyway, that's HTML5 tag. And okay, so you see that after the presentation, you saw here on the recording button. So if I record here, I record both the sound and also the slide movements. And then the expected value of C times B is equal to the expected value of C times the expected value. It's supposedly here.
Which implies, due to the law of large numbers,
Okay, so this is a recording which we made with the software. So after the presentation, you can make a mix of the slides, the laser pointer which was recorded, and the audio, and you have a video replays of the presentation which can be used as a... this was a question on the phone, by the way. The woman here. Okay, that's nearly the end. That's the end, basically. So that's the project information. Thank you.
See, Nicola. So the next one is a guest from Hungary, and I'm sorry. I was just looking at your email address. So, and after that, I would like to see Andreas talking about Apache and slow Iris fail. Is Andreas here? Ah, very good. So.
Test this. Is it working?
Yeah,
working? Great. No? Okay, I have other. I can switch to other.
It's definitely Monday.
Oh,
this looks good.
Okay, I'm Kost. I will talk about Favicon project. Oh, what's Favicon? Yep, okay. So, what it is and why you should care? Well, it's actually just database of Favicon Eco databases and which software they represent. How it looks like? It actually looks like this. We just crawled the whole internet and found the Favicons behind it and tried to enumerate it, which versions you have. So why should you care? Well, if you're a penetration tester, that means you can identify software running. Usually you can identify a web server or web application, but sometimes even version, because favicons also have sometimes some development. So that means you can actually have like Nmap and OpenVAS or W3AF. To check for that software, there is already plugins for it. So this is example of Nmap running favicon enumeration. So it will say that social text is behind this website. So if you're paranoid, that means this is another way of enumeration. Why would you care? Well, they can enumerate what you are running on behind web server or whatever. So it should be good that you change your default favicon. It can be also used for visualizations. We didn't touch too much this part, so you can say you can see top usage of some software, or you can visualize favicons, which one I used more to be bigger, but we didn't touch. So if you want to play with it, feel free to contact us. For criminals, well, it's a nice way to get a few more security complaints, because we've got few complaints, cert incidents to handle, because we just was numapping whole bloody internet. So yeah, it takes time and you get some complaints. For angels, I want to say actually for contributors, well, you can send us a hash of favicon which we don't have, together with software and version. That will be very good, so we can actually have it more better database later. So you can send us via email or via Twitter. You have a Twitter name there, and you can also help us with coding. We have all the scripts there, so you can crawl the internet yourself and build a database. But the most important and painful part is actually that manual part where you have to identify software behind. There, with the help, will be more appreciated. Also, if you have some project where we would like just to implement this, like a web application security scanner or something like that, you can feel free to implement it. Everything is there, database is there, and there is also a few example codes which you can use for it. So these are the links. You can join the mailing list. You can see the web page. there is also a few texts, and these are the projects which already have implemented some kind of enumeration via favicon, so you can narrow down the attacks if you're a penetration tester. So that's it. Thank you. And
ich brauche noch mein Gerät. Also, ich hatte ja damit gerechnet, dass da Präsentationshardware herkommt.
So we're going back to the intermediate presentation laptop, the one which hard disk didn't die until now. Yeah, cross your thumbs. So if somebody has a spare, I think IDE, is it IDE? Yeah, a 2.5-inch hard disk for Sven, because his died today on the presentation machine, on the secondary. The first one is still missing in action. So now we introduce you to Andreas, talking about why Apache and SolarWinds are fail.
Okay, the name of the talk is Apache plus SolarWinds. SolarWinds equals fail. SolarWinds is a pretty simple attack against certain HTTP servers. The idea is that you open many connections to an HTTP server, and on each connection you slowly send a request that will never complete. This uses up resources. It has very low traffic footprint, so you don't need a lot of bandwidth. You can do really denial of service from your DSL. And two vulnerable Apache multiprocessing modules are the prefork module and the worker module, because they have a limitation on the number of open connections, and each connection is bound to a certain process or thread depending on the NPM. And as soon as your slow connections, those that send the incomplete request, as soon as they hit this limit, Apache will stop responding to other requests, and, well, your Apache is unusable. So how can you fix that? There's the way to do it right. Use asynchronous I/O. There are certain other HTTP servers, for example, LightTTPD, Nginx, Getling, or even Apache's experimental event npm IIS from Microsoft. They are all not vulnerable against this attack. So my advice is, if in any way possible, move away from Apache. I, for example, use LightTTPD and enjoy pretty much. If not, patch it. I developed a proof of concept mitigation patch that, well, is based on prior experience with similar attacks. I published it on the Apache developer mailing list. It was mostly ignored. They said, we know it's broken. We need to finish the event npm. And the idea is to reward clients that send reasonably fast and punish slow clients that send virtually nothing. And it's done by reducing the connection timeout for each connection, for each new connection, based on the current load, which is computed every few seconds. And clients that send reasonably fast will have no problem with it, but new connections opened by slow senders will be dropped quickly. Well, the proof of concept patch for prefork npm is linked below. How to do it wrong? There were several other ideas posted on the Apache developer mailing list. For example, mod SolarWinds. It detects attacks by counting the number of open connections per client. It does so by using the IP address. Trusted clients can be whitelisted. The problems are, of course, doesn't work against SolarWinds attacks launched from botnets. Users behind NetGateway are in disadvantage due to false positives. And who maintains the trusted client list? That's an unanswered question. Mod SolarWinds uses the same approach, different code. Mod limit IPCon uses basically the same approach, and there was another unnamed crazy SolarWinds mitigation patch. If no preprocessors are available, all processors that are currently in read state are killed. That is even more a denial of service to the user. This is all, well, Epic Fail describes it, and it has only been tested with the a proof of concept script, but never with an attack, with a distributed attack from a botnet. So the conclusion is the Apache developers are aware of this bug. They know that their architecture is broken, and yet they do absolutely nothing about it. They even closed a bug report about this as invalid or so. So move away from Apache, or if that's impossible, defend yourself. That's the URL. I hope you can read it. That website is going to stay up, and here are a few links to the software itself and the other modules. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
So, a little change in the schedule. Christoph has a date to which he has to go now, so we changed the direction. Number 35 we just heard, so now we're listening to number 38 if you're looking on the schedule on the wiki page. And then we will continue with number 36, which is 3D scanner. If Brahman is here. Okay, missing in action. So, yeah. So have a look at the schedule in the wiki. I just updated the page.
So, jetzt aber. Ja, Computerspiel im Unterricht. Ich will es schnell machen. Ich werde nicht über etwas Technisches sprechen, weil ich dafür schlichtweg zu blöd bin. Lauter, ich muss lauter sprechen. Ich bin zu blöd für Technisches, also spreche ich über Computerspiele im Unterricht. What the fuck ist die erste Reaktion, die alle meine älteren Kollegen immer dazu sagen, warum brauchen wir diesen Scheiß in der Schule? Na, ich werde ein paar Sachen jetzt darüber erzählen, warum das A möglich ist, B, warum ich denke persönlich, dass es notwendig ist, werde dann ein von mir praktisch erprobtes Beispiel mal zeigen und noch eine kleine Kurzzusammenfassung geben. Alles in 4 Minuten wird nicht klappen, mal schauen, wie lange wir brauchen. Möglich. Eignung als genuiner Unterrichtsgegenstand ist so eine Überschrift, die Lehrer direkt verstehen, ihr nicht, deswegen erkläre ich sie euch. Ein genuiner Unterrichtsgegenstand ist etwas, das man irgendwie in Lehrplänen verankern könnte, das irgendwo drinsteht und was Leute, die irgendwie in Schule unterrichten oder da arbeiten, einem glauben, dass es wichtig ist. Ein Computerspiel einfach nur in so einer Freistunde spielen zu lassen, hat nichts damit zu tun, das Ding irgendwie im Unterricht zu behandeln, und darum soll es gehen. Warum braucht man das? Na, zum einen Medienkompetenz, was auch immer das ist. Ich will jetzt keine Definition versuchen, da hat die letzte Chaos Radio Express Folge schon grandios sich versucht dran. Aber es steht zumindest im Lehrplan, und das bietet mir die Möglichkeit, alles, was ich möchte, was ich gerne in der Schule hätte, als Medienkompetenz zu deklarieren, und schon kann ich es machen. Und auf der anderen Seite kann ich Computerspiele momentan wunderbar schon in aktuelle Fächer integrieren. Das ist sehr wichtig, weil die älteren Kollegen glauben einem sonst wieder nicht, dass es notwendig ist, sondern denken nur, das ist schlimme Zukunft oder sowas. Entschuldigung. Man könnte zum Beispiel im Deutschunterricht sich die Erzählstruktur von Adventure Games angucken oder die Interaktivität von solchen Spielen. Oder man könnte, was ich mal sehr spannend fände, was ich aber glaube außerhalb von einer Hauptschule in Brandenburg bisher noch nirgendwo gesehen habe, dass man sich die Belohnungsmechanismen von sowas wie Ego-Shootern oder so, weißt du, abballern, Geld kriegen, bessere Waffe, mehr abballern und so weiter, dass man sich die mal im Pädagogikunterricht anguckt, weil es ja auch möglicherweise interessant ist für die Schüler, mal ihren eigenen Prozess da zu reflektieren. Man könnte noch viel mehr machen, könnte sich Raumkonzepte irgendwie im Kunstunterricht anschauen und diverse Sachen, ist ja jedem von euch klar, auch vielleicht habt ihr noch nicht drüber nachgedacht, aber ein Computerspiel findet immer in einem Raum statt und den kann man sich auch angucken, sogar im Unterricht. Das Ganze bitte nicht falsch verstehen, es geht nicht darum, einfach nur einen Computer irgendwie in die Schule zu stellen und da irgendwie dann zu spielen. Ich habe ein Beispiel im Geschichtsunterricht gebracht, man könnte jetzt Anno 1603 nehmen und sagen, wir analysieren das mal in der Sekundarstufe 2 als Primärquelle. Das klappt nicht, zum einen ist das Spiel keine Primärquelle und zum anderen würde man nicht das Spiel analysieren, sondern irgendwas an geschichtlichem Inhalt, was das Spiel transportiert. Und es geht mir wirklich um die Computerspiele direkt. So, warum ist das notwendig? Warum müssen wir das im Lehrplan verankern? Ich habe mit echt vielen Kollegen gesprochen und habe denen sehr coole fachdidaktische Konzepte gezeigt. Das war alles Dreck. Sie haben gesagt, nee, das geht nicht, das kann alles nicht sein. Und das Einzige, was sie haben gelten lassen, ist der oberste Punkt, ihr Computerspiele sind Alltag der Schülerinnen und Schüler. Ja? Und weil wir denen dann eine Reflexionsfähigkeit zur Bewältigung ihres Alltags an die Hand geben müssen, müssen wir die dann oder können wir die dann auch in der Schule machen. Bitte ignoriert das obere Zitat völlig, so wie den Rest der Slides. Das habe ich nur reingemacht, damit die Leute, die sich in Schule aussehen, mir glauben, dass ich die Literatur gelesen habe, die wichtig ist, um über pädagogische Sachen sprechen zu können. Ich hole jetzt nochmal Luft. Dankeschön. In welchem Maße, also warum brauchen wir eine Reflexionsfähigkeit, um sowas zu gucken, wie in welchem Maße helfen mir Computerspiele dabei, meine eigene Welt zu verstehen? Also Adventure Games haben mir zum Beispiel irgendwie die Möglichkeit an die Hand gegeben, Geschichten interessant zu finden und auch verschiedene Enden von Geschichten vorauszudenken und solche Sachen. Und man kann das wunderbar mit Computerspielen machen. Zum Beispiel mein Verhältnis zum Computerspiel, zum Medium. Was macht das Spiel mit mir? Ein Deutschkollege würde jetzt sagen, das ist ein Immersionsfaktor. Aber jeder Deutschkollege weiß, dass er mit Schülern nicht über Immersionsfaktoren sprechen kann. Ich habe das schon längst gemacht im Unterricht, die wären alle froh. Ich habe dafür über Computerspiele benutzt und nicht irgendwie Faust oder Schiller oder sonst was, was nämlich nicht funktioniert. Ein praktisch erprobtes Beispiel, dafür habe ich die Rahmenbedingungen, die es bisher noch nicht so optimal sind, habe ich beachtet, und zwar im vollsten Maße. Und dann habe ich in der Sekundarstufe 2 in meinem Deutschunterricht eine Sequenz gemacht, wo wir den Medientransfer, also die Übersetzung von einer Geschichte, einem Medium in ein verschiedenes anderes technisches Medium oder Zeichensystem, hier Buch, Film, Computerspiel, uns angeschaut haben. Und was kann man dabei beobachten? Ich bin auch sofort fertig. Na, wie zum Beispiel sich die Erzählung verändert, wenn das in einem anderen Medium erzählt wird, eine Geschichte, weil zum Beispiel im Film eine Bewegung dargestellt werden kann, das kann ein Buch nicht leisten, auf der anderen Seite kann ein Buch aber Gedanken zeigen und ein Computerspiel kann auch die Interaktion hinzufügen und kann uns irgendwie auch die Möglichkeit, durch so kleine Nebenquests an die Hand geben, in dieser fiktionalen Welt zu verweilen. Das war's, das ist die, und das führt uns unmittelbar zur zentralen Erkenntnis dieses Vortrags. Ja, das geht mir in der Schule auch oft so, das Wichtigste zum Schluss und nach dem Gong und dann vergessen. Computerspiele gehören in die Lehrpläne, weil sie an bestimmten Stellen, anno 1603 gehört nicht dazu, an bestimmten Stellen hervorragend sich als genuinen Unterrichtsgegenstand, könnt ihr euch auch mal merken, eignen. Plus, das ist der super Treffer, den wir eigentlich haben, Schülerinnen und Schüler spielen das längst, SOS heißt das übrigens, Schülerinnen und Schüler, die spielen das längst, deswegen müssen wir das in Schule machen, weil wir haben so einen Erziehungsauftrag. Das ist die Literatur, vor allen Dingen die pädagogische, die ich benutzt habe. Ihr könnt damit machen, was ihr wollt, wie auch mit der Arbeit, die ich aber momentan dazu noch nicht veröffentlichen werden darf. Es gibt sie dann irgendwann unter dieser Adresse, kann man sie komplett runterladen unter dieser CC0-Lizenz. Vielen Dank für die Aufmerksamkeit.
Daniel, 3D-Scanner, are you here? Okay, maybe tomorrow. Pablo, Audimax Unistreik, are you here? Probably tomorrow. So, we're coming. Oh. So, Fabian, okay. We are looking for your slides on the secondary presentation machine with working hard disk. Okay. So, Fabian is talking about haptic output techniques on mobile communication devices. And I completely forgot to give you the keywords of today's lightning talk, so let me start this now. The keywords are haptics, mobile phones, digital, physical, and tangible user interfaces.
Looks good. Sounds okay. All right. Hello, I'm Fabian Hemmert. I'm a PhD student at the TU here in Berlin. I work at the Deutsche Telekom Laboratories. And, well, as I'm a PhD student, I have a question, and that question I would like to share with you. How can we make digital content graspable? You know, there is this digital world, and no question, many things are happening there right now, but for us humans, it's not quite tangible, it's not really there. Because we humans, we live in a physical world, and, well, that's a rich world. We can touch it, we can taste it, and we can feel it, and that's good. So the question is, how do we get the stuff over from the digital into the physical world?
Well, if you look at the iPhone with its touch and the Wii with its bodily activity, that's a tendency that's happening already. But the question is, what's next? Well, I have three options that I would like to discuss with you. The first one is mass, weight. We are really sensitive to where an object in our hand is heavy. Let me show you the weight-shifting mobile. It's a mobile phone that can shift its weight. It has an iron weight inside, and we can move that around under the phone. So, well, what we can do is shift it, and you can feel where it's heavy. Well, if you look at the application, we have a drag-and-drop application, and we augment the digital content with a physical mass here. So you can, well, you can see where the content is, but you can also feel it in the phone. Well, that's okay, but it's really useful in navigation. So the phone can guide you around. So it can tell you, okay, well, make a left here, and it's shifting its weight to the left, and walk ahead and in the center, and so on. You get the idea of weight-shifting mobiles here. The second thing is shape. Again, that's something we are quite sensitive to. If I download an ebook and it has like 20 pages, that's a thin ebook. But if it's a 500-page Harry Potter, I want to feel that. So let me show you the shape-changing mobile. So again, it's a mobile phone-shaped box, but this one can change its shape. And, well, you can see it's four motors under it, but yeah. It's fun to play with. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Okay, so it could be thin in your pocket, it could be thick and leaning towards you when you hold it in your hand. All right, it can adjust its shape to the way you hold it, so it's like ergonomics. And, well, maybe some people use it like on the nightstand as a clock, and so you can use it as your wecker. That's simple. Or watch a movie on it. Yeah. But that's not all. Sometimes we are watching things on the phone that are bigger than the phone itself, right? The screen is tiny, but the content is big. So we could use it to show where there's much content off the screen. If I'm on the top left corner, the phone could be thick on the other side and tell you, okay, there's more content off the screen right now. All right. Second thing, shape. The third thing, well, that one operates on a different level. As humans, we are social, we are empathic, and that's good. And, well, wouldn't that be a way to make mobile phones more intuitive? Think of it like a hamster in the pocket, and you could feel, oh, it's doing all right. And, well, very simple, we built a living mobile phone, and that one has a heartbeat and a breath, and yeah, it's calm right now. You can tell it's relaxed. Yeah? That would mean no missed calls, and battery is good, reception is good. But now, oh, missed call, new girlfriend, very exciting. And now it's getting excited as well. Thank you. All right, and you calm it down by patting it, of course. Yeah. So these are the three options I wanted to discuss with you. And what's behind that is that kind of postulation that not humans should get more technical, but technology a bit more human. Thank you very much. I will bring them tonight. If you want to play with them, just try to find me. And I will also bring them tomorrow and be here. So, well, if you want to play with them. All right.
Guys, a warning. Be careful where you put that telephones in your pocket, in your trouser. Yeah. Would be fun to see that on a, yeah, some guys. So, I'm just asking for Joachim and Gego. Are you here? So, Joachim? Gego, okay. If Joachim doesn't show up, Gego, you're next.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, indeed. So imagine that your book in your pocket says, I want to be read now. You haven't read me for like 10 days and starts mating with other books. Hmm.
All right. Are there any more in the room who wanted to give a talk today? Because if we have like somebody missing here, you can step in. There's one here, right there. Just put up your hand if you're interested. It just takes a minute to grab this thing and speak into it. It works.
You know? And important question, is your hard disk working? Okay.
Anyone else? Please let us know, okay?
So they're still looking for the file.
Oh yes, and of course we want feedback. Please give us feedback. You can do this directly on the chat on the Freenode chat channel 2063LT, or you send us an email at 2063@lightningtalks.de. So, or you speak to us after the whole thing here. Just grab a hold of us and tell us what's good, what's not, and I'm pretty sure that you have a lot of things to improve here. So, also we're looking always, for more talks tomorrow and the fourth day. We still have quite a few free slots, so if you can think of your favorite thing to just broadcast, please do. And don't need to give us slides. You can just come up here and do this thing. And the point of it all is to get in touch with people you want to talk to. So instead of putting something up in the wiki and waiting for people to email you, this is the thing. You come up here, you say, this is my thing, this is what I do, I want to get in contact with others. Please come here, all right? You ready?
I came here.
Good.
All right. So. Hi. I'm Gecko, and I just wanted to tell you a little bit about my project. That's elib.at. It's a free online text repository, which basically means that we are some crazy people running around with scanners, scanning old and copyright-free books, on the one hand, which is especially fun if it's in Fraktur or any old script. Try some OCR on that one with a normal, with something like a normal OCR engine. You'll just get nothing readable. So you have to have people who read it, correct it, put it online. Then you can download it and read it on any device, more or less. On the other hand, we try to free content, meaning that we are begging authors to give us the works, which actually works quite well. We have some books which have been published in the wiki, which are still, which you could buy if you wouldn't know that you could have it. Oh yeah. If you have it free on elib, you could buy it on Amazon for around 30 euro. So I think just try it on elib.at, it's easier and cheaper. So what do we do with the text? Here you see just one text, it's, whoa. Yeah, he knows I'm not a Mac. What he basically does is we put all the information online. You see, it's a book. It's even oh yeah, great. It seems well. Perhaps I should switch to Mac. But well, and you have all the information. So we do this just because we are hosted by university, and to keep our hosting space, we have to prove that. How did the other one say that we are somehow useful and that it can be used? In the context of the university e-learning environment, something, whatever, and therefore we do this. But we also have some fun, especially with topics. There's a great topic some of us loved. It was vampires. Some of us are role players, by the way, and. We have a lot of scientific articles about vampires too. Don't worry if you really want to read it, especially the International Journal of Dracula Studies is a great source. followed closely by the International Journal of Buffy Studies. Try that one. That's great. But, well, that's science. And what I want you to do is just, where do we have it? Somewhere around here? Yeah, on the user page of the Lightning Talk, you'll find how to help. Just look at your old hard drives there. I'm sure there are some great papers or something you don't need. They are just sitting there lonely. If there would be a device, they would be crying. And just send them to us, post them on the wiki, or if you want to do something with the texts, we had some artists projecting them on walls or making new versions of it. Everything you want, it's good. They are there to be used, and they are free, and they are for you. So it would be great if you would just participate. You can contact me via the page. Thank you very much.
Okay, so Henry is now talking about the social web, and it seems that this is the last Lightning Talk for today, unless somebody is raising his or her hand. Okay, come on, let's chat while the laptop is configured.
Yes, also, I was asking for feedback in text form, right, for chatting and for email. Of course, if you have taken any pictures, please direct them to us. We'd like to add this to the wiki, especially if you have taken a picture of somebody's first slide, like exactly now. So please send them to us so we can add them. Thank you.
Hi. Well, thank you for letting me come on so quickly. I'm just going to speak really quickly on the social web. In 1980, Tim Berners-Lee put together a project called Inquire. In 1991, he had the first browser. In 1994, in the first W3C conference, he talked about the future of the web, and he had this picture there, which shows how you can link documents. With the web at the bottom is how the current web is currently designed, web documents linking to each other, but how inside of those documents you could describe things and how you could then link these things together. So this was 1994. In 2000, around 2000, the semantic web standards, the core semantic web standards came about, and the FOF ontology, which is a way of describing people, which is well known, friend of a friend ontology, came out. This allows you to do things describe, so the semantic web is everything about relations, subject, relation, objects, like relational databases, but you describe things with URIs. So you can describe Sigri here with a URL, the relation of knowing, and Anya on the right. And with this, you can now build distributed semantic address books. And this is one thing I built a few years ago. So you can start off with something like this. You can drag and drop a home page on it. That will give you, the web browser will fetch the information from a website. This is my website will fetch the information from bblfish.net. If you click on it, on that, you will get all my list of my friends, information about me. And then the nice thing is if you click on one of the people in the second column over there, you will get, say, for example, information about Tim Berners-Lee. Very little information, just his URL. And if you double-click on that, you get information that's fetched from his website that's then merged into your information. So this allows you then to, for example, even add geolocation information to find out where your friends would be. So you can have a completely distributed social network, right? You could put your information on your website, your friends on theirs, and so on, and you can have a completely distributed, decentralized system. So you can use this in the web too. What we've done is we've added a very simple, we've got this little fof.me, site, which is another way of looking at this information. And what we've discovered is that we can use some really nice little clever trick to use this to do a distributed web of trust, so we can add security to this system. And if you click on the, so once you've created yourself a little certificate, you can, which I've already done, you can go and click at the top on the login to your account. Then an X509, the server will ask you for your certificate, and you get this nice little pop-up here. You can choose what kind of person you want to be. And the certificate is sent over back to the server. And the certificate, there is your URL that identifies you. In fact, this is what it looks like. This is what an X509 certificate looks like. There's a subject alternative name inside of the X509 certificate where you put your URL. And as a result, you get this kind of, the server can get this URL, fetch information from you, find your public key, and if they match the certificate, you have identification. This is really what the protocol looks like. So we can create distributed, secure web using Web of Trust, and we're just looking for people to help build websites that can that use this very simple protocol. I think I have here. If you go to if you type FOF plus SSL in any Google browser, you'll get any Google machine. You'll get information. Oh, there's nothing there, right? You'll get information about the. There we go. You'll get information about the protocol here. Oh, the European at the W3C wiki here, which is. So,
okay, Henry, 10 seconds?
Is that it? Yeah, that's it.
Okay, thank you very much.
But we're not. We're not done yet. We have one more talk coming up right there. So we have like 20 minutes left. No, two talks actually. One, and he's also speaking here. You may have seen him yesterday. So there's two more talks. This would give us 10, at least we have room for one more talk. So if you're brave enough to just raise your hand up, there you go, one more, maybe even a second one. So be prepared. You don't have, as I told you, you don't have to have slides or anything. If you're just brave enough to grab the mic, speak out, you're done, okay? Right, you ready? Oh, okay, you don't slides,
yeah.
Right?
Okay. No slides. And I don't even have to grab a mic because it was put on my head. So I'm Michiel Leenaars from NLED Foundation, and I'm here not to talk about the project, but to basically offer you money for projects that you might have. So we're a charity. We got a pile of money when we sold the first internet provider of the Netherlands, and we fund on a global basis things that make the internet better. So, for instance, the RDF stuff that was just shown now, we funded RDF stores, we funded things like Tor and GNUnet and Freenet. We fund office suites because they for implementing open document format. We do lots of privacy-related technologies. And it's very easy. You just go to our website, you ask us for money, and we give it to you. So, and the URL to remember is nlnet.nl. So Netherlandsnet.nl. Don't be fooled by the lots of NL-ness in it. It's global, and you can just ask for money. We have privacy is one of our themes. Privacy, real-time communication. We do a lot on that. We do a lot with open document format. But if it makes the internet a better place, and you convince us of that, chances are that you get your money.
Okay. Wait, bedankt. But can you say the URL once again and very slowly?
NLNET.NL. So internet, but then replace inter with NL, and then you have it.
Okay, bedankt. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to follow on from that last talk about they've got a bunch of money, then they're looking for projects. I'm a project. So it's also quite a good follow-on from the one about the social web and FOF, because if you caught my project from yesterday, then I always had this idea about everybody has their own machine. That's not a server, that's not just sending text. You've actually got data, you're doing operations on your data. So then it occurred to me that there's one special item of data that's really, really important. I'm not talking about who's getting invited to which parties, who's sharing which kind of photos with whom on the social web. I'm talking about the real stuff, okay? That's money. If I'm paying somebody $10, you can say, okay, well, I'm getting a minus 10, he's getting a plus 10. So this is between us, between people. Currently, we have this strange system where there are some trusted third parties, and they are supposed to be in charge of everything. So you don't trust somebody's word, you trust something written with a little bank company. So I thought, okay, can we offer an alternative system of credit that's person to person? This is where it becomes very important to have a strong identity. So I apologize, this talk is another hour talk that's compressed into 4 minutes, or if they're courteous, then a little more. But now imagine you get a call, and they are saying, it's a friend of yours, he says, oh, can you ring me back, please? It's costing me 7 taka per minute, it's 7 units per minute, and you ring him back, it's only going to cost you 2. Would you ring that guy back? Depends on all sorts of things. So the summary is that this is a new form of economics that I have created, and it's about relationships. The normal economics is more about what can I get, and I don't care about anyone else. So I'm saying that there's a concept called sympathy, and if you have that sympathy, that means that you will go without in order to prevent your friend from losing. So what this means in terms of the relationship, you give it a number. That's the indifference value. If you don't know, should I call, should I not? If you're at 0, then you never call them back. If it's your mom, and you know, well, when she dies, I'm going to get all her money anyway, then that's 1, because you're saving your own money. So now we've got a friend of a friend. That's a good friend of yours. So does that have a sympathy value? Well, it does. You do the math. It turns out that it's a product if there's only one path. And you can make these little axioms. That's what I've made. But what we're making is a social web, and it's a network of relationships. Now, you've heard that you get what you measure. So we are measuring altruism. We are measuring how much you care about people. So what we have got here then is not a market, because in a market, I'm looking at the prices. I go to my price comparison site, and okay, maybe I'll think about, do I trust these guys at all to even give me the product? But in a network, everybody is different. People have sympathy for who they're dealing with, and everybody's position is unique. So money has a history. Okay, you're used to saying, how much is it worth to me? You express yourself in numbers. So if there's 2 people working together, they have got, you're hoping that they're having a good day, they're helping each other, they both like it. So I'm afraid this is quite a lot to talk. I'm making a criticism of society. People end up doing the things that are bad for both, like we're taking each other to court, and would it be easier if we just didn't bother? Yes, it would, but somebody has an idea, I can get some money off of this guy. So money is forcing people into the lose-lose quadrant that I'm talking is a sign of a sick society. We should be in the healthy society. That's the win-win quadrant. But due to how we score it, then there's the idea that we must compensate any kind of value transfer. I was discussing this yesterday with somebody, and he's saying, you know, for every winner, there must be a loser. And it got as far as, well, okay, so maybe you're having sex with somebody and you're having a good time, you're winning, but you're losing your time. Like, we have got a... We have this idea that it's all about winners and losers, and we can't just accept, okay, life is a gift. Some things you have just got because you are given them, because we are always competing for things. You know, you're selling something, you want to get a little bit more money. Does life have to be like that? Well, if we phrase things in terms of money, yes, it does. Because money says, I'm only getting as much as he's losing. So if I want to get more, I've got to make him lose more. So I'm sorry, this animation's a bit slow. You basically learn that life is about fighting, you know, from the time you realize that Tom is out to get Jerry. So here's another way that we could do business. We can just honestly state, this is how much it's worth to me. Someone else says, this is how much it's worth to me. And if there's a wide gap, they're both saying, this is a really good thing. I don't want it, I'll give it to him. So there's an incentive there to be honest. That is not about one person wins, the other one loses. So we have a cooperative mentality. We like to cooperate, but we also have to pay the bills. And this is the money system that forces us to compete with one another. So another way we could do it, now this is if you had a sympathy of one with somebody, this is how you would score it. This is the created value. So you'll be ready to maybe you pick up your friend from the station. That costs you a little bit of time, but it's worth a lot to them. And you wouldn't do it for a stranger, perhaps, but you do it to your friend because you are thinking about life through their eyes. You're saying, I'm going to be selfish, not for just me, but for me and the people I care about. Now, it seems to me that is missing in our society. So interpersonal transfers aren't relevant. Is this a way you can run a money system? No, because it does actually matter. If you're giving up all your time to help people, it would be nice to get something back. So what's the solution? Well, we have got two people with two opinions. Let's just say that they can make their own opinion, and I don't have a right to tell somebody else what is their opinion. What have we got? We have got a two-dimensional system. We can do mathematics. It's not so hard. A computer can do it. If we are passing around a little piece of paper or a little piece of metal, it's not possible for me to... We have the zero-sum constraint. We have to be fighting about who gets to have them, but we are not, because we do computers. So I can make a record, you can make a record, okay. We can have an algorithm that says... Okay, that's the model. That was an idea I had. This is from about 5 years ago. And then I said, okay, how are we going to program this? We have some very important things that identity has to be protected because we are not talking about just Facebook data. This could be economic data. So let's make a network of XML virtual machines with a strong identity so that you know who it is who's helping you out. And when you are crediting them for what they've done, you're not giving it to some IP hacker there. So that's what I've been working on. I feel I should give some more time because I don't want to run over from the... Okay, I'll wrap it up with the next slide, which is the practical implementation. This is what it will look like. So it'll look like this. You want something done and say, what do I want? Okay, someone to fix my laptop. I can't fix laptops. Then you're getting offers. These are people who have said, I have an ability to fix a laptop, and requests. So like Google, there's a lot of pages out there and you want just a few of them. This system can say, put the people towards the top who have helped the most and they have received the least help. These are the people that you should be helping. And it doesn't tell you who to help, but it's based on another assumption that's the reverse of ordinary economics. This assumption is that people like things to be fair. So it's going to show you all the people and it'll say, oh, for the requests, help these people, they have an imbalance. I'm not making a not suggesting a centralized system, I'm suggesting a completely decentralized system, but instead of using money, this will be another way that you can get things done. So it's putting people in touch with other people, and it's very reliant on the semantic web and the strong identity. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for that. I hope you realize that I allowed him to speak a little bit more because if this sets off, this is going to be life-changing. So where can we meet you again if you want to get in touch? Please tell us.
Thank you, Sven, for a thoroughly unscripted piece of relations. Yes, I need to point that out. I'm sitting on a table marked friend to friend, that's downstairs in the hacking zone. And there is a website, friendtofriend.net. If you can remember the phrase altruistic economics, then you can Google on that. And I've published about 10 or 20 different papers on presentations on this. And maybe you can get another one tomorrow in 4 minutes. You're getting super concentrated. But I have been living in Bangladesh and I don't know many people here. So I can speak, ich kann ja auch Deutsch reden. Also Deutsch oder Englisch, das gehen die beiden. Also das wäre gut, wenn ihr mir vorbeikommen würdet. Ne?
Thank you very much.
And I briefly read up on altruistic thing there. So I see this man has a background in statistics, as you've probably seen with the slides there. Anyway, last talk for the day. I fear it is, but yes.
Yeah. I just drew this. I forgot to put my name on the first slide. I'm Lars Aronsson from Sweden, and I run a literary website. And I'm involved in Wikipedia as well. But this is a totally new project based on the Swedish general elections that are coming up in less than 1 year now. We're a democracy. We have general elections every fourth year. This election will be an exciting one because the Pirate Party is running for the first time, and internet issues could become important. We don't know yet, but they could become important. This also means that all the traditional parties will be starting blogs and try to seem hip, trying to get voters from the Pirate Party. So it could be an exciting election on the internet. Generally, we have libraries and archives to keep documents for the future so we can understand history. This is a problem with the web, because the web changes all the time, and how do you know what the web was last year? Can you really trust the websites to maintain their own history? No, you can't. You really need independent web archiving. And this is what Brewster Kahle said in 1996 when he started the Internet Archive. As you probably all know, at archive.org, you can go and find old versions of websites. Nearly every website, maybe not your new website, maybe they missed that website. How do you know, really? How do you know that they cover everything? And do we really know that historians? Is there any historian here?
Yep, and we use it.
Do you actually use it?
And we teach it to the students.
That would be very interesting for me to hear actual usage stories, because it's easy to invent the web archive, but does anybody really use it? I would like to know that. So in Sweden as well, we have a national library, and they started a web archiving project already in 97. And they have been archiving Swedish web pages. But for concerns for privacy and copyright, blah, 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 they have invented an excuse to not make this publicly available. You have to go to their building in Stockholm and one specific terminal, and there you can search for old Swedish web pages. But what's even worse is that now they are closing down this service during 2010, and they will restart in 2011. So they will miss the entire election year. Could we hear an applause for that? That's just incredible. So what are we going to do? This is my question, and you should write an email to my address at the bottom there if you have any idea on how we should solve this. Could we set up our own web archiving? I mean, we can't think for a year. We should get started right now. There is the Internet Archive has released their software, the Heritrix, so that I guess we could use that software and set up our own web archiving. But will that be useful to future historians? And will we be able to capture all these new information streams? I mean, we have Twitter streams. Does the web archive cover that? I don't think so. So how do we do that? How do we cover leaked documents that are on the Pirate Bay for a week and then go away? How do we preserve them for the future? So there are many questions, and please write to me or get in touch with me here if you have any ideas on how to do this. Thank you.
Tack så mycket, Lars. Thank you very much. And now the final words from Sven.
Yes, we hope you really enjoyed this. We want your feedback. If it's good, to tell everybody about it. If it's bad, just send it to us via email. Don't Twitter it. No, seriously, Twitter about it, email about it. We might be missing your feedback because, you know, there's only so much time. But so we appreciate you sending us an email about this. 2063@lightningtalks.de. I hope you'll be back tomorrow. And if you have a talk, please get in touch and we put you on. So see you tomorrow.
same time here, 12:30.